I have a coffee mug that a friend gave to me. And on that coffee mug is my favorite particular cartoon from my favorite cartoon strip. I know you all are far too pious to delve into the worldly realm of cartoons, so I'll have to explain a little bit about this particular series of cartoons that is modern, it is cynical, it is Dilbert. In this particular cartoon, Dilbert is quietly busy about the work and in his cubicle, facing his computer, typing away, when that evil man comes behind him, that evil man with the pointy hair, and he says to Dilbert, "I've decided to be a more hands-on manager." And Dilbert sits at his desk, and in the next frame, Dilbert's boss says, "Move the cursor over there, over there. Click it, click it." And Dilbert's thought bubble says, "I can see this is going to be a long day." It is seemly and right and appropriate, fitting in our own minds that God should control the big things. It makes sense for us that God should create the universe. It makes sense for us that God should determine who shall rule in what nation. But somehow, it seems to, in our minds that somehow God would be some sort of meddling boss if he were to control the details of our lives. I remember when I was in graduate school at Ole Miss, and, you know, there are fun things and there are burdensome things about being R.C. Sproul's son. At Ole Miss, they had a campus ministry called Reformed University Fellowship, the campus ministry of the PCA. And there was a campus minister there. He was a new graduate from Trinity, actually. His name was Durant Fleming. And Durant came to be the campus minister for RUF. And the poor fellow, he's got all hundreds of undergrads, good, sweet, southern kids that just sat and listened to everything he had to say, whereas I would go to the meetings and I would sit in the back row and I would put my knees up on the seat in front of me and sit there with my arms crossed and wait for him to mess up. Now, he was my friend, you understand, but this was good for my ego for me to be able to catch him saying things wrong. And, of course, he's looking at him. There's R.C. Sproul's son looking at him like this. It kind of threw him off. But he was very gracious to me, and we're still very good friends. Thankfully, this was a small group and not a big group. I went to one of his small group Bible studies, and he was explaining the sovereignty of God, the interrelationship between the sovereignty of God and the free will of man. And what he did is, he, on the chalkboard in this little room, he drew a line, sort of like, well, a curvy line, something like this. And then about 6 inches below that line, he drew another line that followed the same pattern. Looked like a river, you see. He said to his students, "Now look, God's sovereignty and man's free will are like these two lines. God has determined which direction, where things are going to go, but inside, below, above this low line and below this high line, inside there, there's room for you to move. You can't go outside the line where God would lose control, but inside the line there's room for you to move. That's how these two things relate." And I sat there. I didn't have a seat in front of me to put my legs up on. I didn't have my arms crossed and looking pretty friendly, I guess. And Durant said, "What do you think, R.C.? Makes sense?" You know, the students all just sat there. So he asked, he knew I'd say something. "What do you think, R.C.? Does it make sense?" And I said, "Well, Durant, it's a beautiful illustration. It absolutely nails the point, except for one small thing. one little adjustment I'd like to make on your diagram about how these things relate. He said, well, what would you change about it? I said, well, do you mind? And he said, no. I said, well, you see this line here? He said, yeah. I said, you see this line here? I said, here's the only change I would make. Then, then you have it, you see. But God's sovereignty is not some vague, general, I'll make sure it works out some way in the end sovereignty. It covers everything great and small. Now, we started together looking at the creation account. And the creation account, though it is longer than God made everything, it is rather short. I mean, everything in here is rather short. This is my travel Bible. I'm not yet 40 years old, though I am Presbyterian. I don't yet have presbymyopia, but I'm getting closer. In fact, it's really strange. I've developed the mannerisms of someone with presbymyopia, even though I don't have the symptoms. There are times when I look at something, I can't see it very well, and I'll go like this. Like, I've got bifocals out here somewhere. I don't have any bifocals. But all of God's Word fits in this little book that I can hold in the palm of my hand. I can stick it in my pocket and take it with me everywhere I go. Everything God had to say, He said here. And so when you come to the creation account, it doesn't talk about all that God did. There's no exposition. When God said, let there be light, the Scripture doesn't tell us what light is. I mean, we still don't know what light is. Right? Light is a strange, strange thing. The scientists will tell you that sometimes light behaves like a particle. But there's no mass to it. And then they'll tell, well, I mean, the particles have mass. Then they'll say, no, sometimes it behaves like a wave. But yet it does things that waves don't do. In fact, they call it a wavicle. As if some sort of combination. What is this stuff? Even Einstein says things about light that aren't true. He said this. He said, and he's famous for this, that when things approach or reach the speed of light, they will have infinite mass. Do you hear that? Not true, you understand. I mean, if it were true, what would happen every time you turn on the light? Everything would get smashed. Smashed tighter than those two lines. And an infinite mass coming down on you. Talk about a headache. Turn the lights off. Light goes the speed of light. And yet it doesn't have infinite mass. Because light's not the only problem. What about matter? What's matter? Now, I mentioned that I'm not yet 40 years old. I keep mentioning it from now until I'll be 40 years old. I mention it every few hours or so. I'm not yet 40 years old. But I'm old enough for this, that when I was in junior high school, in science class, my science teacher was Mrs. Lemon. Mrs. Lemon was about 300 pounds and an angry feminist and an atheist. Mrs. Lemon. Gosh, man. Sorry. she would explain to us, she said, when I was in school, they taught us the plum pudding theory of the atom, where there's just this sort of gelatinous stuff and there's little raisins in it. But we know how silly that is and how foolish it is. Now we know, of course, about the nucleus with the protons and the neutrons and the electrons dancing around outside. And we know that the smallest things that stuff is made out of are protons and neutrons and electrons. Can't get any smaller than that. Hey, you should raise your eyebrows. In the time since I was in junior high, we have discovered, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 or 6 more levels of subatomic particles. And we have found some weird stuff. And we found so many more layers that we've all virtually run out of words about what to call this stuff. Okay, we got molecules, we got atoms, we got electrons, protons, neutrons, and then what? Muons and quarks. And then what? Luckies? Have you heard of this thing? It's a little small thing. It's called a lucky. And there's a happy. I don't know if there's a dopey and a sneezy. Coming up later, I guess. Subatomic particles until we remember that it is actually a small world after all. But Einstein, even though he was wrong about light, he was sometimes right. You remember Heisenberg uncertainty principle or the Brownian movement? What's the thing that says molecules will move around at random? Anybody remember that? No scientists here? Or am I so dumb that I can't describe it close enough? Brownian movement? I used to, when I was in college, all my friends were engineers, and we would have debates, not about theology, but about science, and things, and often, what's it called, real small science, what we're talking about, Einstein's small, real small stuff. nuclear physics, yeah, I guess so, now there's another name. Quantum physics, thank you, good. Quantum physics. And we would be having these debates and they would be explaining about Brownian movements and I was just so skeptical I'd start to answer them and I'd crawl over the corner of the room and I'd get in the chair and stand up and reach the corner. I'll scoot you all the oxygen's up here in the corner and I'll be right back with you in a second. Einstein was right. When Heisenberg and others who argued that stuff happened at random said this with great wisdom, God doesn't play dice. This stuff, these small things are so strange, they tell us things like this, they tell us that when you show up to watch them, it changes them, right? There's a principle for that. What's that one called? That's Heisenberg. There you go. See that? I'm pretty close. Heisenberg's principle, yeah, you show up and all of a sudden they start dancing for you and doing something different than they would have if you don't show up. How do you know they're not doing this when you don't show up? You don't know. And it gets worse. Then they tell you, oh, there's a subatomic particle right here. And then it stops being. And then it shows up over here, but it did not traverse the distance. Have you heard this? This is great stuff. It was here, and then it ceases to be. And then it starts to be over here, but it didn't traverse the distance. I think what it does, I think it actually travels through the land of lost socks and shows up over here. So. But it doesn't matter how small the parts are. When you take two hydrogens and an oxygen, you put them together, what happens? Well, there are holes in the hydrogen rings, the electron rings of the hydrogens, and there's electrons that like to get together, and everybody's happy because all the holes are filled. There's no extra electrons, right? That all happens. Why? We don't know what stuff is, but we know that somehow this does happen. And what science does is try to go, like we did with time, going back and back and back and back and back. It tries to ask why and why and why and why, getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. But sooner or later, you are forced to answer why does this happen, why does that happen? You sooner or later have to answer either no reason or because God wills it. Heisenberg said, no reason. Einstein said, because God wills it. And Einstein was right. It has to be that way. God controls even the tiniest things. There are no contingencies. There are no uncertainties. Interesting. This is a quarter of a Federal Reserve note. And this does two things. It will buy 12 and a half pieces of gum, and it will settle disputes. It'll buy 12 and a half pieces of gum at the store, it'll settle disputes without having to go to the store. How do we settle disputes with this? Like that. Right? Now, why does it work for settling disputes? Let me ask you the question this way. If I were to... This is George Washington. He's heads. This is a picture of the state of New York and the Statue of Liberty. We'll call that tails, okay? Now, if I flip the coin, what are the odds that it comes up heads or tails? 50-50. Everybody say 50? And you're all wrong. Except for those of you who've heard R.C. do this. R.C. the less handsome. Know the answer. It's not 50-50. What are the chances, I asked, what are the chances it will come up heads or tails? 100%. That's absolutely right. I have heard Dr. Sproul the less handsome do that. I knew the answer to that. Okay. When we say 50-50, what we mean is it's 50% chance it will come up heads, 50% chance it will come up tails, assuming it doesn't fall and land on its side somehow. Which I can't do. So, when we speak about chances, what are we saying? What causes it to come up heads or tails? Tails. What causes that? God's will? Anything else? Approximately? Is God up in heaven going, oh, heads? It is heads. It would have been tails if I hadn't dropped it. Oh, God, there you go. There he goes. It's heads, don't know it's tails. It's heads again. Certainly God is the ultimate cause. That's our point today. But what causes it proximately, secondarily? We say it happens by chance. That's the value of this in settling disputes. No one can, I can't say, I'll take heads. Oh, it's heads. You know, I can't make it happen the way I want it to happen. And so we say it happens by chance, but what really causes it to happen secondarily? Well, it's a combination. It's a passel of vectors. That is, there are any number of causal chain or events that come together to make it happen. Look at it. I mean, do I start with it heads or do I start with the tails? There's the level of the force of the thumb, right? Do I drop it and do it? Do I do it from here? Do I do it hard? Do I do it light? Then there's a question, do I catch it up here? Do I catch it down there? There's barometric pressure here. How much is it pushing down? There's humidity. There's wind currents. There's butterflies in Japan that are flapping their wings. And then, of course, also the big question that's going to determine everything, do I do the flip or do I not do the flip? This way or this way? All of those things come together to create one way or the other. In fact, that's the point of it serving as a dispute settler. There's so many causes, so many secondary causes going on in this that I can't possibly control them so that it becomes a way for us to settle our disputes. I can't rule over this. I can't get it to do one thing or the other. But that's not the same thing about saying it has no cause. But first we need to understand that God not only knows which way it will come up, He not only determined which way it will come up, but He determined the combination of forces that would make it be that way. This goes back to in the beginning God. I said, one of the forces is barometric pressure. Well, what caused that? Well, the butterfly in Japan. What caused that? Well, the butterfly's mama and daddy. And what caused that butterfly? And back and back and back and back and back till what? Till in the beginning God. One of the things I used to dispute with my engineering friends, they would be doing their homework, and I would come in and make a nuisance of myself so they'd quit and come play with me. And, because I was a liberal arts major. they'd be doing their homework and I would hear them ask each other, well, how many digits until they're insignificant numbers? Is that the right expression? Insignificant digits. Have you heard about this? You're doing a math problem, and you can just like lop off the last few numbers if you want to, because they're insignificant. I'm saying, wait a minute. Insignificant digits? There are no insignificant digits. You can say, all we need to know are tolerances within here and there. That's fine. But they're not insignificant. It makes a difference. You can do pi down to 9 digits, or you can do pi down to 9 million digits. And it probably is not going to make a big difference in the circle you draw on your piece of paper. But all of those digits matter. And the same thing is true with respect to all of these causes. All of these things have real causal power. That butterfly in Japan makes a difference. Which is why God has to control all the details. Someone told me that, having heard me on the radio a time or two, every time I pause, they hear dun 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 dun. Never thought of that. There's a difference, friends, between saying, I don't know what the cause is, and saying there's no cause. There's a difference between saying it's a secondary cause and saying God has nothing to do with it. Both nature, friends, and the Bible tell us, and by the way, the Bible tells us that nature tells us, that God does in fact control all the tiniest details. That He is a micromanager. Romans chapter 1 verse 20 says, for since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead sit there without excuse. God's power is over everything. He controls all things. And we see this, I think, most clearly in the story of Ruth. You know the story of Ruth. Here's Elimelech, somewhat pious Jew, married, has 2 sons, and God, in His sovereignty, sends a famine, sends a drought. And Elimelech, like the Job family, decides, let's head on down to Moab. I understand you can get work down there. And they move down to Moab, and they make their way there, and they survive as a family, and the 2 sons look around and find themselves some wives, Orpah and Ruth. And then what happens? Elimelech dies, Orpah's husband dies, and Ruth's husband dies. And now here's Naomi with 2 Moabite daughters-in-law. Now, Moab is not a nice place. In Moab, if you're a woman without the protection of a man, you are in danger. And Naomi begins to think about that thing, and she thinks, you know, back home, as I recall, they have rules for how you take care of people like me. They don't throw you to the wolves. They have a system there. I'm going to go back home. And she says, Ruth, Orpah, I'm going back home. You guys stay here and get you some new husbands. And they say, no, no, we're going with you. And Ruth says, or Naomi says, no, you stay here. And Orpah says, okay. And Ruth says, whither thou goest, I will go. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. So now Naomi and Ruth go back to Israel, and they get involved in the whole gleaning thing. They're gleaning in Boaz's field, or she's gleaning, Ruth's gleaning in Boaz's field, and Boaz decides she's kind of cute, and tells his hands to, drop a bundle or two off the wagon her way, so she doesn't have to work so hard. And then we have this strange scene in the threshing floor, and then the two of them are married. Now, one of the things we see in this story over and over and over again is some very interesting language. Verse 1 begins at the beginning of verse 1, Ruth 1:1a. Now it came to pass. Verse 19, and it happened. Chapter 2, verse 3, and she happened to come across. And it happens again later on in this story when Boaz wakes up on the threshing floor. And it happened, and it happened. Well, what things happened? You all know what happened in the end. Ruth and Boaz marry, and God blesses them with a son. The son's name is Obed. And by and by, and it happened that Obed married, and Obed and his wife had a son, and his name was Jesse. And it happened that Jesse eventually married, and Jesse and his wife had many sons, the last of which was David. Now think about it. You've heard this. I don't know if it's a poem, if it's a ditty, but it explains the relationship between the details and the big things and helps us understand that there's no distinction. It goes like this. How does it go? It goes, for one of a nail, the shoe was lost. For one of the shoe, the horse was lost. For one of the horse, the rider was lost. For one of the rider, the battle was lost. For one of the battle, the war was lost. Now, imagine a war being determined by a nail. And yet it's true. In fact, we can see it here. For one of a drought, there's no Naomi in Moab. And for one of a marriage, there's no Ruth with Naomi. For want of a Jewish godly system of caring for widows, there's no Ruth back in Israel. Oh, I'd say this too. For want of Naomi's graciousness and kindness and character, there's no Ruth saying, whither thou goest, I will go also. You think about that. Think about children. Where are the children? Look at me up here. Imagine this, if Naomi had not said to Ruth, when Ruth helped her, thank you, please, you're welcome, if she hadn't been gracious and kind and polite, maybe Ruth would not have loved her as she had, and therefore would not have gone back to Israel with her, and therefore there would have been no David and no Jesus. How small is that? For want of the back to Israel, the marriage was lost. For one of the marriage, the child was lost. For one of the child, the child was lost. For one of the child, the child was lost. For one of the child, for the one of David, there is no son of David who was David's Lord. Now don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying we were this close to not being saved. in one sense. In another sense, I am saying we were this close to not being saved. Because the God who ordained our salvation ordained everything down to the subatomic particle level. It had to happen. It had to bring it. He had to bring it to pass. Now, that God controls these details down to this level, however, we need to be careful, doesn't mean, as we go back to the issue of suffering, it doesn't mean we know why. It's one of the dangers, what turns Calvinists into mystics. Calvinists are people who rightly believe that God ordains whatsoever come to pass. Mystics are those who wrongly believe they know why. I remember being in high school. My high school English teacher was an atheist, intellectual, pseudo-intellectual. And he had us read several different Puritan things. We read the Edwards' Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. He knew he had a strange student on his hands when I kept insisting, no, you don't get it. This sermon's about grace. It's about grace. You see that fire over which the spider hangs? That's where the spider should be, you see. But God's holding on because God is gracious. Well, then there's this other sermon by this Puritan. And in this sermon, God bless the Puritans, I love them. But this Puritan, you remember what the Puritans were. What were they trying to purify? Trying to purify the church, what were they trying to purify it from? All those wicked and horrible Romish extras, including the Book of Common Prayer. You know, these written, read prayers. God forbid. You know, like the Psalms. Here's the sermon. The pastor, you know, who doesn't want any of this extra stuff, wants to just do the Bible. His sermon is not on the Bible. His sermon is about what happened one day. He came into the sanctuary. Excuse me, the meeting house. See, these are Puritans. Came into the meeting house and found something in the corner. There in the corner were the remains of a copy of a particular book. But the reason they were only remains is because they were also remains of what was left of the book after the mouse's body had processed it. That is, the mouse had chewed up this book and then left a calling card to let you know that the mouse had been there. Okay? The mouse came and ate up the Book of Common Prayer. And the Puritan pastor went to great lengths explaining how God from all eternity had determined that this extra, spare, not unused copy of the Book of Common Prayer should somehow be left in the corner of this meeting house, and that God from all eternity had chosen this particular mouse to be born into this particular place, and on this particular day this mouse was wandering through this meeting house and it came upon across this book that God had planned to let there from the beginning of time, and that the mouse did in fact eat up the Book of Common Prayer. Now, has the pastor said anything wrong yet? Sounds silly, doesn't it? That God chose this particular mouse to eat this particular book. But you know what? He did. So far, so good. But here's the problem. He goes on to say, God, in this act, demonstrates His displeasure against the Book of Common Prayer in our meeting houses by having this rodent chew it up. And oh, how I wished I could climb into my time machine so that I could sit in one of those pews and raise my hand and say, Pastor, of course I would never interrupt a worship service, Pastor, isn't it possible, just a possibility, I'm not asking that it has to be so, but isn't it possible that God did in fact ordain from all eternity that that particular mouse
would be born, and that particular mouse would walk across the building in that particular hour, in that particular day, and run into that particular book, and then he would eat up that book. Isn't it possible that God would ordain all this so that we would learn that even God's creature, the mouse, knows how wise it is to feed upon the Book of Common Prayer? God's ways are not our ways. God does what He does, but it is God who's doing it. But the Bible doesn't just show us this in the story of Ruth. It tells us this. Matthew chapter 10. And when He had called the 12 disciples to Him, He gave them power over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease. Now the names of the 12 apostles were these: first Simon, who's called Peter, and Andrew his brother, James the son of Zebedee and John his brother, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew the tax collector, James the son of Alphaeus and Lebbeus, whose surname was Thaddeus, Simon the Canaanite, and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed Him. These 12 Jesus sent out and commanded them, saying, "Do not go into the way of the Gentiles, and do not enter a city of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go, preach, saying, 'The kingdom of heaven is at hand.' Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out demons. Freely you have received, freely give. Provide neither gold nor silver nor copper in your money belts, nor a bag for your journey, nor two tunics, nor sandals, nor staffs, for a worker is worthy of his food. Now whatever city or town you enter, inquire who in it is worthy, and stay there till you go out. And when you go into a household, greet it. If the household is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it is not worthy, let your peace return to you. And whoever will not receive you, nor hear your words, when you depart from that city or house, shake off the dust from your feet. Assuredly, I say to you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of the judgment than for that city." Now imagine being one of the disciples and hearing Jesus say this to you. This is not details. This is big doings. This is big power. This is big stuff. This is power religion. Go out there and cast out demons. Go out there and proclaim that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Go do great stuff. Wouldn't you be excited? Probably for the first time since you've been with this Jesus, you're thinking to yourself, "I wish Jesus would just hush so I can go do this stuff." You would be giddy with excitement. And how important am I? Jesus says, "I am so important that when I show up, if people aren't nice to me, those people are going to be judged worse than the Sodomites and the Gomorrah." That's pretty heady stuff. But Jesus doesn't stop. Jesus says, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. You will be brought before governors and kings for my sake, as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, do not worry about how or what you should speak. For it will be given to you in that hour what you should speak, for it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you." Wait a minute, Jesus. We're going to go out and deliver people from demons, and the fruit of this is we get arrested. We're going to get arrested. But you're saying, "Don't worry, because you'll tell us what to say at our trial?" "Now brother will deliver up brother to death, and father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake. Let me be more careful here. Brother will deliver up brother to and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents. You want to talk about warfare? This is ugly warfare. And causing to be put to death. And you will be hated by all. This is not, guys, it's going to be a really fierce battle between us and the bad guys. And those bad guys are going to really hate you. No, there's this fierce battle going to go on, and they're all going to hate you. Okay, we do great things. We get arrested. We'll be told what to say. And we'll be hated by everybody. The disciple, you'll be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end will be saved. When they persecute you in this city, flee to another, for assuredly I say to you, you will not have gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. A disciple is not above his master, nor a servant above his master. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It is enough for the disciple that he be like his teacher, and a servant like his master. If they have called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more will they call those of this house, of his household? Therefore, do not fear them. There is nothing covered that will not be revealed, and hidden that will not be known. Whatever I tell you in the dark, speak in the light, and what you hear in the ear, preach to the housetops. And do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. So all these people that you're nervous about, don't be afraid of them, but rather fear him, who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. What a wonderful thing. If we were doing the series of talks I do in the family, this is what I would tell you about our family liturgy. Questions and answers that I go through with my children to help them understand who they are. One of which is this. I ask the children, whom do Sproles fear? And they're taught to say this. Sproles fear no man. Sproles fear God. Which is precisely what Jesus commands here. Now, having said all this, go do great things. You'll be hated. You'll be arrested. Don't be afraid. Fear God. Now what? Jesus says, are not two sparrows sold for a copper coin? And not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father's will, but the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore. You are more valuable. You have more value than many sparrows. Isn't it interesting? Think about the book of Revelation, which we looked at last night. The book of Revelation is written, friends, not ultimately so that Jerry Jenkins can get really rich. It's not written ultimately so Hal Lindsey can get really rich. It's not written ultimately to tell us details about the end of time. The function of the book of Revelation originally was to tell God's people who were in the face of persecution that Jesus Christ reigns. It says it very vaguely. We're not given the details. If we were given the details, then maybe we would know what's going to happen in the future with great detail. Maybe we wouldn't have such eschatological debates. But here, in the face of coming persecution, Jesus, instead of saying, but don't worry about it, I'm king, he says this, don't worry about it, I control all the details. I control all the details. The very hairs of your head are all numbered. Now, of course, that's going to be all that more poignant to people like me who watch that number decrease day by day by day. But it's also the great comfort. It's a small and petty thing to lose one's hair, but it is, when we're small and petty people like me, a distressing thing. But there's not a hair that falls from my head that God did not determine from all eternity. It's not just when I'm having kidney stone attacks that God is there. It's not just when I lose
a close friend to death that God is there. It is when it's everywhere. It's when a hair falls from my head. God's sovereignty knows no limits. It's the same reason you understand. Why does my hair fall out of my head? Is it DDT? DHT. DDT is poison for your garden, I think. DHT. Someone knew it right away. DHT. Too much DHT, which, you know, by the way, is a testosterone. The baldness is caused by too much male hormone. So if the rest of you guys want to spend your male hormones on hair, go right ahead. Too macho. And what causes the DHT? I don't know. But God does. And whatever causes the DHT, God does. And you know, whatever causes these things involves little tiny molecules. And you know what causes those little tiny molecules to be the way they are? Little tiny atoms. You know what causes those little tiny atoms to be the way they are? Protons and neutrons and electrons. And you know what causes them to be the way they are? Muons and quarks and luckies and happies. And what causes them to be the way they are? God. It's all God. As I've described something, as I've said it before, let me make it clear. You understand that everything that happens, happens because of a causal chain. This caused this, this caused this. There might be a whole bunch of things that go into the causal chain. What do I call it? A passel of vectors. But every link in the causal chain is caused by the previous link. That's why it's called a causal chain. And you keep chasing the link back and back and back and back and back. And where do you get? In the beginning, God. As we said last night, God's sovereignty is not just in the dance of the stars, it's the dance of the subatomic particles. It's all His. There is no thing for which He is not the ultimate cause. Now, I'm not denying secondary causes. I am denying that secondary causes are ultimate. They're secondary. They're means which He uses. Means which He created. Means which He determined. Means which He is Lord over. No better place than the greatest sermon given by one who was just man. Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, the man attested by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did through Him in your midst, as you yourselves also know, Him being delivered how? By the determined purpose and foreknowledge of God, you have taken by lawless hands and crucified and put to death, whom God raised up, having loosed the pains of death, because it was not possible that He should be held by it. What is He saying here? Here's a detail. How many pieces of silver? 30 pieces. Here's a detail. What town would He be born in? Here's a detail. Think about all the details in Jesus' life. Think about being an Old Testament scholar in the Old Testament times. Reading through the Old Testament and thinking, okay, Messiah is from Bethlehem. Messiah comes from Egypt. Messiah is a Nazarene. And from the tribe of David? How is this going to be? How can it possibly be?
And yet there they are, in Bethlehem, where he's born. And then they flee, where? To Egypt. And then they go where? To Nazareth, where he's raised. Nazareth. That place up north where he was raised. It's all there. All little details. In fact, friends, it's true that there are no details. But it's not only true for the lives of those who are in the Bible, but it's true for us as well. You know, talked a little bit about personal suffering. And I hesitate to talk about this as suffering because she's such a joy. But I have a daughter, Shannon, who's 6 and she's retarded. She doesn't speak. She probably never will speak. She's basically mentally about a year old, physically about 2 years old. Well, 2 years old in terms of ability. She's about as strong as an ox. We call her Bam Bam. And she was diagnosed with her condition when she was about 14 months old. And soon after she was diagnosed, my parents called and my dad said, "Well, son, how are you taking this?" And I said, "Dad, God has been preparing me all my life for this. You don't get to be R.C. Sproul's son without God saying, you're going to believe in the sovereignty of God. And you don't get to believe in the sovereignty of God without God saying, let's see if you really believe in the sovereignty of God. God has been preparing me for this for my entire life." And it's true. And I don't lose a day's sleep over the sovereignty of God and my daughter Shannon. In fact, I get sleep because of my belief in the sovereignty of God and Shannon because of what a delight she is. But, you know what? When I have to go somewhere and I turn the ignition on my truck and it won't start, then I become an Arminian. But you see, the same God who determined from all eternity that my Shannon should have fewer abilities than other children is the God who determined my truck wouldn't start. Who determined, you know, that I'd drop a glass and break it. Who determined that my hair would fill the drain in the shower. It's the sovereignty of God is not just in the big events that somehow don't touch us. It's not just in the details of the famous people in the Bible. But it's in the big events of our lives. It's in the little tiny events of our lives. Everything. In between there, it's not when my car won't start, but when the plane won't start. Tomorrow I go back home, God willing. It's an amazing amazing statistic that in my travels, I'm delayed overnight. I've been delayed overnight on my way home 10 times for every one time I've been delayed overnight on my way out. And the one time it happened on my way out, it was after I made it to Atlanta, but before I made it to New Orleans. My wife knows, if the phone rings tomorrow afternoon, my wife is not going to want to answer it. She's going to know it's likely to be me saying, dear, flight was delayed. Here's what's funny. It doesn't bother me. I long to get home, but it doesn't bother me because it's outside of my control. But what's interesting is it does bother me that it bothers my wife. I'm more concerned about having to call my wife and tell her I'm going to be late than I am about being late. But you know what? That it bothers my wife is as much under the sovereignty of God as that the plane didn't land or it couldn't take off. We need to get that in our relationships, especially husbands and fathers. There are no details over which God is sovereign. When you begin to ask yourself, "When Lord, the woman thou gavest me, I'm having a hard time understanding this." Then become a Calvinist. Then the sovereignty of God. So tomorrow morning, in the teaching hour, I'll be talking more about husbands and wives and children. And then, I don't remember what, Almighty Over Redemption as we preach. These are not details. Friends, again, the conclusion I want us to get is this. I want us to be like what I want my children to be like. I want us to be what Jesus commands us to be like. Because God is sovereign over all things, big and small, we must fear no man, but fear God. Because He is the God who controls all things. Let's pray. Gracious Father, again, we thank You for bringing us together this morning, and we thank You that Your sovereignty knows no limits. That we're not left to wander about within some sort of constraints, but that we indeed walk the very specific path that You have set before us. Father, we pray that it is Your pleasure and it has been Your will that the path that You have set before us is the path of our sanctification and Your glory. And we hope this with confidence, knowing that You have determined that You who have begun a good work in us will carry it through to the end. Father, we thank You for this promise and for the promise of Your sovereignty, that You love us more than sparrows. And we thank You especially for Your Son, Jesus Christ. For we pray in His name. Amen.